You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest, A.J. Swoboda, pastors Theophilus Church in urban Portland. He's the executive director of Seminary Stewardship Alliance and teaches at Portland Seminary and Fuller Theological Seminary, among others. He's an award-winning author or editor of 9 books and speaks regularly at conferences, retreats, churches, and seminaries. His new book is called Subversive Sabbath, The Surprising Power of Rest in a Nonstop World. AJ, thanks for coming back to Seminary Dropout.
I'm so glad to be with you. Thank you so much for having me, Shane.
Listen, I do want to talk about the book, but if it's okay, I would like to talk about something else first.
Sure.
You and I were both at the Missio Alliance Gathering Awakenings last year, and you were kind of a co-MC for the event. I've served as an MC for a number of gatherings. I think I guess something about hosting a podcast. You know, I'm not an expert on anything, but I can talk good, I guess. I've filled that role. It's harder than people think, I think, and it's especially hard to make that an interesting role. You did such a great job, and if it's okay, I want to play a clip of something. You were in charge of introducing N.T. Wright, one of the main sessions, one of the main nights that we were there. This clip is a little bit long. It's a little over 4 minutes. I want to play that real quick.
Well, we've had an opportunity to do a brief introduction of Professor Tom Wright and kind of his academic background. There's one thing left out. He was on the Colbert Report a long time ago, which was important. The truth is, I've been invited to just kind of make a personal introduction to Professor Wright as he comes up. I was 16 years old when I became a Christian. I was in my math class in high school. The two girls behind me were arguing about when Jesus was coming back. And I had never read the Bible, was raised in a non-religious home, and I went home after hearing this argument, which was my introduction to Christianity, went home and started reading the Bible. And I had a powerful encounter with the living God in my bedroom at 16 years old. And when I was 18 years old, I went off to school. I went off to college, and I went to the University of Oregon. And when I went to U of O, I started taking religious studies courses. And I had never heard people talk about the Bible the way that religious studies professors did at U of O. And they started showing me some very interesting things in the Bible that I didn't have answers for. And I started to kind of pull my faith apart a little bit. And I remember I was 18 years old, having just taken a class, and I was sitting in my car on an afternoon, and there was an AM radio station in Eugene where you could call up, and there was this guy who had every answer for the Bible you could ever want. So I called this AM station, and he said, "What's your question?" And I told him the question, and I finished, and there was a silence at the other end of the line, and he said, "I'll get back to you." So he says, "I'll get back to you," and he ended the call, and about a week later, I get this little microphone recording, and he said, essentially, "Don't worry about your question. Just be a Christian. Sweep the question aside. Just continue to keep doing what you're doing."
Wow.
And at 18 years old, that really harmed me, and for the first time in my adult life, I felt like the Bible was actually getting in between me and Jesus. And about 6 months later, a friend of mine, after telling him this story, as I was kind of walking through this season of deep deconstruction and pain, gave me this book. It was a little book called The Last Word. And the book is about the Bible. It's basically an examination of the Bible and how we approach the Bible. And I read this book. Some of us have had books in our life where we sit down and we remember where we were when we read it. And we remember the smell of the room and the way the room felt. And I sat down in a Starbucks for 5 hours and read this entire book. and realized after reading this book that the Bible never will truly make sense if it's not set in the context of a really good, generous God. That the Bible only makes sense in the context of grace. And I read this book by Tom Wright, and he gave me permission to come back to Jesus and struggle with the Bible as much as I needed to, but I could come back. And I'm standing here, I think I'm standing here because somebody gave me that book. Wow. But ultimately because somebody wrote it. And for a lot of people in this room, Professor Tom Wright has given a whole generation of people permission to love Jesus with all their heart and still use their brains. Would you please welcome our friend, Professor Tom Wright.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
AJ, the thing about that clip that I think about is, for one, Wright had spoken a few times already that weekend, and it's obviously customary and appropriate to give an introduction each time someone speaks. And so, you know, we had already heard his academic resume a few times. Right. And so it's very difficult and obvious. And the other thing is, it's N.T. Wright. We know who he is. But you gave that, like you said, a personal introduction. The room was like blown away by that, by your story. And I wish I had the recording of what N.T. Wright said in response to that. He had never heard that story that you told. And he was quite moved by it. You could tell he was very, very moved by it. And I also realized hearing it again that he's obviously mic'd up, sitting off to the side a little bit.
Right.
You can hear him responding to your story. When you knew you were going to introduce him, did you know that was a story you wanted to tell?
Yeah. I mean, I certainly knew that I wanted to tell that story for the simple fact that, we all have a certain degree, a certain number of stories in our lives where we always hearken back to, stories in our life that really were foundational and formational. And of the four or five kind of early formational books that I read and people that informed me, I mean, Tom was that guy. I mean, I was so enamored with his work and so transformed that I was at Harvard. This was a couple months after, about a year after that story. I was at Harvard and I had a friend who was at Harvard, found out Tom was giving a talk at Harvard, and she allowed me to borrow her ID card, and I snuck in to go to the student union presentation that he gave. And I mean, it's just his life, his work. As a writer, you often hear the words of people that disagree with you, but every once in a while, when you hear the words of somebody who's been transformed by your work, it makes a tremendous difference. And Tom needs to know those things because he takes a lot of heat for what he does. And he deserves to be told the stories of how his work has been used by Jesus. And we all should be telling Tom those stories because he's a living legend. And in 100 years, seminaries and Christians will still be reading Tom Wright and wrestling with the work that he has contributed to the body of Christ.
Well, I think that part of that, why that was so moving, is because a lot of us had similar experiences with Tom, his work has meant so much to us. I think that was partly why we identify it so much. Did you get to talk to him privately afterwards?
I did for just a few minutes, and he was so gracious and generous to me and thanked me. Yeah, I mean, what's amazing about Tom, everybody's been in a room with a super wickedly brilliant human being, and then when the mic is off, they're really mean.
Right.
And Tom is just so, it's amazing how generous and kind and self-sacrificial he is. And he was just but he was just buzzing with grace and generosity. And so we had the chance to chat for a few minutes, and one of his PhD students is a good friend of mine. So I've had the chance to interact with him a little bit through that too. But yeah, what a living, you know, we're just a living legend. And we had the privilege of getting to see him, just what a remarkable opportunity.
Yeah, I completely agree. I've had the fortune to have him on the show twice, and
Have you really? Wow.
Yeah, and I haven't got to talk with him off mic a lot, but just, you know, before the recordings and everything, and you can tell that he is such a genuine person. Our friend J.R. Roscoe told the story about just in their planning of that Awakenings gathering, his newborn was having some health problems, and every time they jumped on the phone to plan for Awakenings, Wright was asking JR, you know, how's Aiden doing? And can we pray for Aiden?
Wow. Now I should tell you, Shane, the hard part, the worst part was on the next day when he had the morning session, and he went really, really too long.
Did you have to cut him off?
It was my job to cut him off.
Oh dear. Yeah. Yeah, that's so a no-win scenario.
How do you cut Tom right off? Yeah, you don't do the hand across the throat thing, because that's threatening. So you gotta find something to tell Tom. And so I just gently said, I kept whispering, Tom, we're almost there. Yeah, but man, what a just, yeah, he generous, real, and we all need to just thank God for the gifts that we've been given in Tom Wright.
Okay, so this is the last question I'll ask about this story, but do you remember the question you had that you asked the AM radio host?
Yeah, it was, yeah, exactly. I know exactly the question. If any of your readers were to go and look at John 5:4 in their New Testament, they would find that it's not there. The text in most translations goes from John 5:3 to 5:5. And there's a verse completely missing. And I read that. I'd never seen that before. And it sent me on a faith tailspin. And, obviously years later, I have a way to understand it and know what the story is behind it. But the truth is, when you are taught that the Bible is the foundation of your faith rather than Jesus being the foundation of your faith, that's a very difficult thing to come across. And the point of the Bible now, as I relate to Scripture, is the Bible is the inspired word of God, but the Bible's job is to point us to Jesus. Jesus doesn't point us to the Bible. It is pointing us, it is a signpost to Jesus. And so, you know, but at that moment, that was a really painful realization. And I actually have more respect for, more love for the Bible now than I ever have, and believe in it more than I ever have, in an appropriate way.
It's so interesting how just holding in the Bible in the place that it's meant to be held, turns that question from something that is, you know, faith destroying to a kind of, okay, so, you know, so what? It doesn't have any bearing on our faith in Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah. Or at least the bearing that it does have is not destructive. Unfortunately, I've just seen so many kids raised in the church who are handed a particular vision of the Bible and then go take one class at a university and their entire faith is destroyed. Either the vision that we're handing people the Bible is wrong. People have really compelling arguments against the reality of the Bible. And honestly, I just think that there are so few arguments against this the importance and beauty and authenticity and the power and authority of the Scriptures. So I honestly think we're just handing people often an overinflated, almost divine expectation, like it's, you know, the fourth member of the Trinity or something like that. We just have to have a better way of explaining what the Bible is to people. I love John Wimber, who started Vineyard, is a kind of a hero of mine, and he always had this saying that the Bible is a menu. And his point was, you know, when you go to a restaurant, they hand you a menu, and you look at the menu to find out what you want in the kitchen. And you get the food and it comes out. But you never make the menu the meal. The meal isn't, you never sit there and start eating the menu.
Yeah.
The point of the menu is to get what's in the kitchen on the table. And if we hand a vision to kids where the menu is the meal, they're going to find that the menu it's not going to get you very far. The point is to get what's in the kitchen on the table. The point is that the Bible would bring us to Jesus. That's the goal.
Yeah, I've never heard that metaphor. I like it. So let's talk about subversive Sabbath.
Let's do it.
Do you think that for modern Christians that the idea of Sabbath has fallen out of favor because that's an Old Testament precept and we're New Testament people? I mean, is it I have a feeling it's probably more practical reasons why it's fallen out of favor. But theologically, do you think that that's why people haven't pressed into it?
Yeah, wonderful question. So just to be clear for, you know, kind of the purpose of the book, I mean, I wrote this book, Subversive Sabbath, as almost an apologetic for the fourth commandment, an apologetic for this remembering the Sabbath day. Because we have, and by the way, it's the only, I find it interesting, it's the only commandment in the Ten Commandments that begins with the word remember. None of the other ones begin with remember. They're all do not. But this one starts with remember. And I think God knew, he's always known from eternity that this would be of all the precepts that we're invited into, it would be the one most susceptible to amnesia among God's people. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you look at the Sabbath through scripture, right? And Sabbath is weaved in and out of the entire Bible. And you can't even get out of Genesis 1 and 2 without the Sabbath. God created Adam and Eve. He made them on day 6, and day 7 was a day of rest, which even in that, there's a kind of beautiful little insight that, you know, for Adam and Eve, their first day of existence was a day of rest, which to me is, you know, the first image of the gospel in the Bible. God always extends rest before we're expected to work. God always allows us to rest in him before we get the work done. there is a certain degree, as you raise this issue, there is a certain degree of Sabbath hostility in the church. I preached 2 years ago on the Sabbath for 3 weeks in our church, and I have preached on all sorts of things that have upset people in my community. I preached on sexuality. I preached against marijuana. I have to. I live in Portland. I've preached on things that have really upset people. And I preached on the Sabbath for 3 weeks, and I've never had more people leave the church. Just on the simple idea of taking a day of rest a week. Not only, you know, is there hostility, but we literally structure our churches around breaking the Sabbath. I mean, if you take the Ten Commandments, which you go through these Ten Commandments, if I was to break 9 of them, I'd probably lose my job, right? If I committed adultery, I'd probably lose my job. If I stole money from the church, I'd probably lose my job. If I committed murder, I would lose my job. But if I, you know, don't keep a Sabbath, then I'll probably get a raise because I'll be way more effective and get a lot more stuff done. And I think honestly, at the end of the day, I don't think that we make a theological argument against the Sabbath. I think it's a practical issue. I think we are idolaters and we worship productivity. And the Sabbath goes completely against our entire way of doing church and life, where we have turned our work into our God the way that Adam did when he worked the soil and the soil produced thorns. I think that we have worshiped our work. And when you worship the work that we've been given to do, Sabbath becomes the most hostile concept ever. But in answer to your question about the Old Testament, even if somebody said this is some Old Testament idea, which it is an Old Testament idea, and it's a New Testament idea, and it's a heaven idea, you can't escape from it. Our future is in heaven. The new heaven and New Jerusalem will be in Sabbath. But even for the person who says, you know, this is some Old Testament precept that we don't need to observe anymore, similar to eating bacon, I would say, what one of the other Ten Commandments would you say is Old Testament and not something we're called to? Is adultery just so Old Testament? Is not murdering, do we not need to worry about that one? I mean, we basically become a nine commandment people. We should stop putting the Ten Commandments up. We should just start etching one of them out and putting the rest of the nine up, because we have nine commandments in one suggestion.
I thought it was so interesting. One of the things you said in one of the early chapters was the other religions at the time were at the time of, you know, the Old Testament, their gods were really, were about working people to the bone. It was very subversive, to use the title, subversive, and it was radical for this God to come on the scene who commands rest. And I don't know, for me, I find Christianity and especially Jesus, the divine part to me comes out in those part, in those places where they're so counterintuitive, you know, more so than the miracles and signs and wonders. Like, those are great things that I affirm, but God comes on the scene and says, I want you and I command you to take a break once a week. And Jesus comes along and says, turn the other cheek. There are these things that are so counterintuitive to the way human beings think that things should be ran.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Al Bayless, who's a professor here at Multnomah University in Portland, wrote a book called From Creation Across to the Cross, in which he talks about these creation stories in their context. And ultimately, when you read the creation stories, which the creation stories in the Bible actually have all of these remarkable consistencies and similarities to the other religious traditions. So the Akkadians, the Egyptians, the Phoenicians, I mean, they're all, these other religions traditions have a creation story that's very similar to the creation story in the Bible. And they're all radically similar in many respects. What's unique about them is not their similarities, it's their differences. And you connect these two sides, the two religious creation stories, and you find that the creation story in the Bible offers something that none of the other creation stories and all the other religions do, and that is that God refuses to treat people like slaves. He treats people like human beings. And he actually gives them a day of rest a week. I mean, we literally worship. If you're a Christian, right? You worship the God who invented the weekend. Mm-hmm. This is the God that invented this day of rest, and to not do it. I mean, this is, we got to understand that Sabbath predates any of the law. This is built. It's literally built into creation. Which is why when you read the stories of Sabbath in the Old Testament, it's the Sabbath is not just for human beings. It's for animals. It's for creation. It's for the alien among you. It's for all of these different people. The creation, Sabbath is built into creation. If animals that need to hibernate don't hibernate, they die. If we don't sleep, we die. We were created to need rest, and to not rest and to not Sabbath is to live a genetically modified life. And anybody that says, I don't need Sabbath, you know, I don't need it. Well, I got news for you, bucko. You will be taking a Sabbath. You will be taking a sabbatical. It will come. Whether you choose it or not, it will come, because it's built into creation. We need it. Even Jesus rested. And how many times in the Gospels is Jesus caught sleeping? He's sleeping all the time. And he's always sleeping when his disciples are awake. And he's awake when his disciples are sleeping. In the Garden of Gethsemane, he's wide awake where his disciples are sleeping. In the boat, he's sleeping where his disciples are all afraid. Even Jesus. And I guess at the end of the day, my question is, are we better than Jesus? And if we're better than Jesus, we're in the wrong religion, because in this religion, Jesus is the top dog. He takes the cake.
I had a pastor tell me one time that he just worked and worked and worked, never took time off, never took a Sabbath, and wound up having a nervous breakdown and was in his bed for like 3 weeks and couldn't get out. And it, man, talk about, yeah, you're going to take one either way. And that was really what he took away from it. He was like, man, if I had just taken off, you know, periodically, like I should have, you're going to take it either way. The body keeps a record.
Yeah. What a great book, by the way. Preston Sprinkle turned me onto that book. Yeah. Our theology around the Sabbath is not informed more. It is more often informed by cliche than it is the biblical text. How often have you heard somebody say the phrase, I don't need to take a rest. I'll never take a Sabbath because the devil never rests. Which, at the end of the day, at what point did we start basing our discipleship models based on what Satan is doing today?
Mm.
You know, like, busyness is in the biblical text actually a demonic characteristic. And never once in the Bible is God described as being busy. Jesus is never busy because when you've invented time, you can't be late. You can't be busy for something. In fact, the devil is the only one that's ever described as being busy at the very beginning of Job, when he comes to God and says, and God says, "Where have you been?" And Satan says, "I've been running to and fro throughout the earth." Mm-hmm. Busyness is a demonic, satanic characteristic. It's not a divine characteristic.
I want to talk about just the Sabbath in relation to community for a while. Isn't it interesting, and you're so good at drawing this out in the book, the way that Sabbath draws community together and the richness of it?
Yeah, well, you know, we have a lot to learn from our Jewish friends who have been doing this for thousands of years. You know, if you go to a modern city, if you go to any major city where there is a synagogue, there are all of these expectations among Orthodox Jews who live in the city. And that is that if you live within the city, you have to live within walking distance of the synagogue for two reasons. Number one, so that you don't have to drive on the Sabbath to get there. But secondarily, so that when you are going to the Sabbath services, you have other people to walk with. And when you look at this, the way Sabbath is done among Jewish communities, there is no separation between Sabbath and community. Sabbath and community are one. This is why Jesus is always caught being in the Gospels. He's always in the synagogue. He is always around other people on the Sabbath because it was intended to be a day that brings us together. That actually, I think historically and biblically, there's a very strong motif, very strong theme around this. And that's a freeing idea for people. I've observed in the last couple of years of both writing this book and doing some, you know, having the chance to share it with people, is that for single people, the Sabbath is a really scary idea. Because for Sabbath people, they often feel like that just needs to be another day of the week where I'm all alone. And the first Sabbath was God, Adam, and Eve hanging around, rocking around in the garden. The first Sabbath was simply them walking around and talking about everything God had made. The Sabbath is supposed to be a day where we are with people that we love. I can tell you in my family, it's the one day that I just need to be glued to be on the floor with my son playing Legos, because that is Sabbath diversion and it needs to happen. So no, Sabbath and community go hand in hand. They always should and they always have.
A lot of times when I read people who are proponents of Sabbath, they'll appeal to this idea that not taking a Sabbath is actually counterproductive, that taking a rest will actually make us more productive on the days that we do work. And I think there might be a place for that, but I think that's also a very, very American way to even do Sabbath, is to do it because it will make you more productive. And one of the things that I really appreciated that you stuck to was appreciating Sabbath for the sake of Sabbath and of itself.
Mm. Yeah, as in, what if I hear you correctly, not doing the Sabbath for an ends of getting something else, but doing it for itself.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, the number one question that's a great point. The number one question that I get when it comes to the Sabbath is, there are two questions. Number one, and I'd love to talk about this in a second, what about the poor? Can the poor Sabbath? I get asked that all the time. And then secondly, and this is just so telling of where we're at, is when I talk about the Sabbath, the question is, well, what am I supposed to do on the Sabbath? Which is, as you just said, I mean, that's just such a, it's an American question. We can't even talk about rest without thinking about it in the context of doing something. We don't even have a construct for that. My friend Mark Cartledge, who is my PhD advisor, once told me that when you fly to America, obviously you have to fill out one of those little visa cards. And for people who are not Americans come, they have to fill the visa card out and they give you two options for travel to the U.S. It is either work or it is vacation and play. Hmm. We are given two reasons to exist if we come to America. And that is our paradigm for existence. We are either working or we're playing. There is no construct for just being with God and with people. And you're absolutely right. Which, by the way, the truth of the matter is that people that do keep a Sabbath actually, or people that do rest a day a week, actually do end up being more productive. There's actually literature that points to that.
Yeah.
But if we do that as a tool to become more productive, that is problematic. That just becomes us using a gift from God for our own purposes rather than enjoying it because God gave it to us and it's good.
You brought up something I had not thought about at all, the idea of those in poverty taking a Sabbath. And I get where I could hear someone saying that that's the idea of a Sabbath is a privilege thing. You've got the privilege to be able to take a Sabbath.
Yep. Yep. And the truth is, the Sabbath, you know, the number, if I was to name my greatest criticism and my greatest struggle with the Sabbath, it would be precisely that. What about the poor and people in poverty? Because for me to say, take a day of rest a week, well, what about the single mother of eight who has to work 80 hours a week just to put food on the table? And all of a sudden, I'm here telling her that God wants her to take a day of rest a week. And I've come to kind of two conclusions about this. Number one is the Sabbath has to be embodied by people in power. And here's why. If people in power don't rest, then the poor will not rest. And how can I say that? You look at organizations like Chick-fil-A and Hobby Lobby, which I have all sorts of feelings about. But when you look at those two organizations, you know what? I give them a lot of credit because they shut down a day a week every week and lose billions of dollars so that people can go home and rest. It is somebody in power choosing to say, I'm willing to make less money to support people being able to be at home. I do not think that the poor will be able to Sabbath until the people in power are first willing to do it. I'm mentoring a guy right now in New York who is burning. He is literally burning out before my very eyes. He's 35 years old. He weighs 300 pounds. His heart is dying and he needs a day of rest a week. And you know what? When he goes to a senior pastor and he says, I need a day of rest a week. You know what a senior pastor says? Why should you need a day of rest? I never needed one. That is a story of somebody in power who's keeping somebody else from entering rest. And the truth is the poor will not rest until the people in power start doing it themselves and extend it to others. And the second thing I would say is I would say that this idea of the Sabbath, the minute it becomes a new law, we have lost it. The Sabbath was given to us. We were not given to the Sabbath. And if we start causing the Sabbath to become a new law that just enslaves those of us, then we do not understand the Sabbath. The Sabbath is a gift. It is not a new law, and it is not something intended to re-enslave people who are already suffering. John Golden Gay wrote this phenomenal book a few years ago. He talks about this idea. John Golden Gay is an Old Testament professor at Fuller Seminary, and he talks about this idea that he calls the ideal and condescension in the Bible. And that is that in the Bible, God always gives us the ideal picture of something. He always gives us an ideal picture of sexuality. He always gives us an ideal picture of society. He always gives us an ideal picture of what marriage should look. He gives us these ultimate ideals. But the truth is, we never meet those ideals. Those ideals are always beyond us, and only one human being ever has ever lived it, and that was Jesus. The ideal is always beyond us. But God knows that. And so what God does is when God sets up the ideal and he knows we won't make it, all he asks is that we begin to seek God's ideal. And that as we seek God's ideal,
God always condescends to our level. In seeking to go towards the ideal, God condescends to where we were at, where we are at. So when I'm talking to a person in poverty, and when I'm talking to a single mother of eight, and she goes, listen, I can give 2 hours a week to just stopping and being with God. That's what I've got. My response is, you do 2 hours a week and God will meet you. I would say, do what you can and God will always meet you. So the minute this becomes some new law, some new regulation that just seeks to put the poor in some new level of guilt and shame, then we have not understood the gift of the Sabbath. God desires that every human being would have a day of rest every week.
Another thing that you mentioned was just the idea, specifically the American idea of vacation. And one of the cases you make is that the Sabbath is different from vacation. And I think that that's super important, because I think there are probably a lot of people out there that say, well, I don't take my Sabbath once a week or periodically so that I could take that 2 weeks of paid vacation per year. And that seems to, one, kind of miss the point and miss the heart of Sabbath, and be almost as destructive as not doing it at all.
Yeah, it's absolutely. Yeah, first of all, and biblically speaking, there is no construct, there's no theme at all that suggest that vacation is not in the Bible. There's no construct for vacation in the Bible. Are vacations bad? No, absolutely not. Vacations are awesome, and we love them, and we do them. But vacations are not God's plan for rest. In the same way that going to church every Christmas and Easter as your total experience of being a part of the body of Christ is not God's ideal picture of being a part of a community. Are they great to go on Christmas and Easter? Absolutely. You should do it. But that is such a small part of God's ultimate ideal picture of rest. The reality is that a weekly day of rest is incredibly invasive. It is incredibly difficult. There rarely do I have a perfect Sabbath. Sabbaths are really hard. They're invasive. But when you take a Sabbath once a week, it is like developing a whole new rhythm in your life that changes the operating system of how you do everything. Eugene Peterson has this little article that he wrote years ago, which really was the beginning of this cottage industry of books on Sabbath. He wrote a confessional on, you know, being a Sabbath breaker. And he talks about the difference between a Sabbath day, which is a day of being with the ones we love, being present to God. And he differentiates that between that and a day off. And a day off, Peterson argues, is that day that we're at home, but we're thinking about work, and we're texting, and we're emailing, and we're planning, but we're at home. And he says, in the Bible, there is no construct. There is no day off. There's only a Sabbath. And he calls a day off a bastard Sabbath. It's this illegitimate Sabbath. That's not what God has dreamt of and what God has really been dreaming of our entire lives. And vacations, again, are awesome. But they cannot replace a weekly day of stopping and being with God. I mean, we just have been created for this. Again, I'd love to be able to take – it would be so much easier if I didn't have to worry about breathing every second of every day. If I could just take one breath a day, like one really big breath a day, that would be just so great. Well, I don't get to determine that. I don't get to determine how often I need to breathe, nor do I get to determine how much rest I need. God has determined that. That's how I'd respond to that.
So I think there'd be a lot of people who hear that and say, okay, but what is the difference between the actual like physical activities I'm doing in the two? And I realize we're kind of getting to that, what do I do question. But if Sabbath is not doing the things that I do on vacation, does that mean I'm like sitting in a dark room all day kind of meditating? Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, so ultimately we're afraid. It's just even that comment, which I know you're not asking that. You're presuming many would. Even that comment presumes a fear of silence.
Yeah,
we are afraid of the quiet. We are afraid of the dark. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I had this experience, when I was growing up, when my parents went through a divorce when I was 11 years old, my dad is a doctor and a phenomenal doctor and worked 80 hours a week. And I remember there were two things that I loved doing with my dad the most. I loved going fishing with my dad on the Boulder River in Montana. And I loved going to Disneyland with my dad. And I've often, it's taken years to reflect on this. Why did I love those experiences so much? And I loved them so much because they were the only times that my dad was not on a call. Hmm. He was not on call. And I took my son. And so when I was with my dad in Disneyland, I mean, it was just dad and his kid. And it was just the two of us. And we were just in heaven. When I went fishing with them, it was just the two of us. I took my son, my 6-year-old boy, to Disneyland last year for the first time. We took him when he was a baby, but we took him last year. First time he really understood what was going on. And we were standing in line for one of the rides. And there was this little boy standing next to us who was standing below his dad. And he was pulling on his dad's shirt to try to get his attention. And he couldn't get his attention because his dad was standing there with his head buried in his cell phone answering work emails. Hmm. And we have this whole new generation of people who know how to be in the room with somebody, but not be in the room with somebody. And the Sabbath, I don't think that the Sabbath is about what you do on the Sabbath. The Sabbath is largely around what you're not doing. You're not running around and working and being productive. You're not working the soil. You're not producing. But I think the Sabbath is the day a week where we, our bodies and our souls and our spirits are in the same place, no matter where we are, that we are present to wherever God has placed us. And that means just becoming whole again. Like today I'm not going to answer texts. I'm not going to answer emails on the Sabbath. I'm going to be home with my family and I'm going to love them and eat really, really, really flipping good food.
I heard someone say one time that if you find out what work is for you and then don't do that one day a week.
Yeah.
I kind of like the simplicity of that, the freedom in that. Cause I think that we've also heard people who get very legalistic about the Sabbath and what exactly are the permitted things to do. I think the Pharisees were really into that in Jesus's time. Yes. As well.
Yes. Yep. Exactly. And the legalism thing, is basically a way to create shame around rest. So you're not resting properly. But if we look at it from a technical standpoint, shame is work. So if there is shame, then you are working and you're not Sabbathing. So there needs to be no shame.
You have a whole section about Sabbath as it relates to creation. That was kind of a surprise because for all of the things that I've, growing up in the church and reading and hearing sermons that I've heard about Sabbath, the relation to creation was not one of them. So I wonder if you could just explain a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, the truth is you can't go too far in the Bible without recognizing that that this creation, that the Sabbath narrative, in terms of its intent. In the fourth commandment, remember the Sabbath day. Don't do work 6 days a week. Don't do any work on the seventh day. And this is for you, your household, your manservant, your maidservant. And then all of a sudden, there's this line in there, and your animals. And then it goes back to, and your aliens among you. And you read the whole Old Testament, and you find very quickly that the Sabbath is applied to agricultural practices. You have these sabbatical years where the land is to go fallow. You have the year of Jubilee where the land once again is given rest. And you look at the intent of the Sabbath and you find, my goodness, this is so expansive. This is not anthropocentric. This is about all of creation. This is about all of all that God has made. And there's all of this fascinating material that's coming out around how creation, if it doesn't rest, if it doesn't have a chance to rest, it will die. I mean, there are, I'm a wholehearted believer in and have written whole books on the topic of you know, the way that our actions are affecting the world, climate change, these sorts of things. And the truth is, you know, for example, when animals are affected by climate change, for example, animals that that need to hibernate and they can't do it, I mean, they just die off. There's all of this, all this stuff coming out around noise pollution and whales. When whales, you know, are constantly being kept, they can't sleep because of the sound of boats all the time. I mean, there's all this interesting stuff that comes out that I think actually reflects deeply this theme in scripture that the land, the animals need rest too. We have six chickens at our house, and I can tell you right now, they love the Sabbath. We do not collect their eggs on the Sabbath. We don't bother them on the Sabbath. And the day before the Sabbath, we give them a ton of extra food. They love the Sabbath. They love it. And they lay more eggs the day after the Sabbath. So I think ultimately just this theme is very unexplored, the Sabbath and creation theme. And it's so integral and so important. You know, what does it mean? I know it sounds like so silly, but everybody's got pets now. What does the Sabbath look like for your pet? What does the Sabbath look like for, you know, if you work the land? What does it look like for your land? What does it look like for your garden? What does it look like for your enjoyment of God's creation? I mean, I think the Sabbath is a day that we should get outside and enjoy God's creation and see it and smell it, to learn to stop and smell the roses. We don't have time to do it anywhere else. What if the Sabbath became a day that we just got to enjoy God's creation? So this is a theme that I think we've got to attend to. It's biblical through and through, and has deep ramifications for our engagement with children. Children, for example, I bring up children because there's this phenomenon, obviously, of nature deficit disorder, which is that kids are not getting outside anymore. They're spending all their time inside playing video games. And the Sabbath is one of those opportunities to get our children out into creation, to enjoy this miracle of God's created realm. There's even creation. Paul says in Romans that creation screams the invisible qualities of God, that God's creation, his goodness is seen in all creation. And children are created by God to have opportunities to be blown out of the water by what he has made. And if we don't have opportunities to do that, like on the Sabbath, our kids are just, I think depression rates are just going to skyrocket. We were intended to get outside.
I had the opportunity to interview Richard Foster, and there aren't many people who have more of an impact on me than Richard Foster and his works and writings. And one of the questions that I wanted to ask him was what his spiritual disciplines were. And for him, a really, really big part of the way he connected with God was just being outside and going hiking and being around nature. And you had a great anecdote in the book about, you know, someone who was ministering to kids who lived in the city and how he just couldn't seem to help them connect with God. And so he took them to a camp outside of town and just saw how their eyes were open to God, but just simply because they were in nature.
Yep. Yeah. There's a guy in our church who leads more inner city kids to Jesus than I've ever known. And he lived his entire like apologetic as he takes kids in the inner city camping. And once they see the stars, they start asking all the questions about God. And at that stage, it's a foregone conclusion. They want to believe in Jesus. Mm-hmm. I mean, God has created, creation is intended to be God's love letter to human beings. If you've ever had a mango, it's hard to eat a mango and be an atheist. I mean, it's just so good, right? You eat authentic Thai food or authentic Indian food. You just have to believe that there's something out there. This doesn't come from anywhere. It's not a mistake. These things are, there's this powerful line too, in John Owens, who was an old Puritan revivalist, and he was being burned at the stake. And somebody wrote down his last sermon. And he has this line where he says, friends, foes, look at creation around you. This is the creation God has given to his enemies. Can you imagine the one he will give to his friends? And it's this line, I mean, that this creation in its broken state now is absolutely beautiful. We can't even imagine what it will look like in the future.
So I wonder what you think would be the impact if Christians were known for as people who took a Sabbath regularly. And, you know, I think the word is witness. What would that witness be to the world, and what impact would that have?
Well, it would, in a world of exhaustion and distraction, the church should be, you know, the one place where people know they can come and rest. I think the most important article that I read last year was an article by Andrew Sullivan. Andrew Sullivan is writer who writes about popular culture. He's written about, you know, digital stuff, and he wrote this article called "I Used to Be a Human Being," and it's about distraction. And he was one of the first people to do blogging years ago when it started, and he completely burned out doing it. He blogged like 13, 14 blog articles a day and just burned out and quit the internet. And he's a secular gay dude. He's actually quite, at least in his writings, acerbic towards the faith. He doesn't strike me as somebody who in his earlier writings was interested all that much in faith. And now he's come back to writing, and he wrote this article called "I Used to Be a Human Being," and he all of a sudden is starting to talk about God and talk about faith and the church. And in this particular article, he makes this comment near the end of the article that I'll read to you about distraction and about the church and ultimately about the Sabbath. He writes this: "If the churches came to understand that the greatest threat to faith today is not hedonism but distraction, perhaps they might again begin to appeal to a frazzled digital generation. Christian leaders seem to think that they need more distraction to counter the distraction. Their services have degenerated into emotional spasms. Their spaces drowned with light and noise and locked shut throughout the day, when their darkness and silence might actually draw those whose minds and souls have grown web-weary." That line, he says, that the greatest enemy to faith today is not hedonism, it is distraction. Hmm. It is not hedonism, it is distraction. The church that learns how to do rest for a frazzled digital generation will become an oasis of hope and grace. And for us to become a people of rest in an exhausted world, we will become a city on a hill, salt to the world. And again, I don't know if there is a more important evangelistic tool in our time than a people that know how to rest. There's a great book written a few years ago by a guy named John Murray. I believe it was John Murray. He wrote a book called On the Sabbath. And he talks about Jesus, when Jesus encounters the woman at the well. And he says that text, the whole text begins with Jesus sitting by the well. He sits down. And by sitting, Jesus was aware of what was going on. He was able to see. And I think that there's some for when the church has a chance to just sit and see, we will begin to see things that we never saw before. We will be in tune with the Spirit of God in a way we've never been in tune before. We will be present in a way we've never been present before. And we will begin to see our neighbors in a way we've never seen them before. I think a good evangelist needs a day to sit by the well, just a day to sit.
You know, the practice of Sabbath, there's a lot that it does in the way of spiritual formation and shaping our character. And I wonder how you see that working, how God uses Sabbath to really make us more like Him and, you know, make us in, you know, renewing our minds through Sabbath.
Yeah. Well, I think that can be a good closing point for me. I mean, I think our minds are more exhausted now than they've ever been. You know, you look in 8 generations past, and it was a different kind of exhaustion. Listen, when you work the field all day long, when you spend your life farming, that's a certain kind of exhaustion. But we're exhausted now, but we don't work the land like the way we used to. At least most people don't. We're in a new kind of exhaustion, and that is an emotional exhaustion, a mind exhaustion. We are taking in more content and information than we ever have. And I think the Sabbath provides for people who are emotionally, spiritually, and intellectually exhausted a day to stop and allow our hearts and minds to be present to Jesus and the Spirit of God. I personally don't know anybody in my life who is spiritually well-adjusted, who is spiritually healthy, who does not keep a Sabbath. There seems to be a direct relationship between people who know how to take a day a week of rest and are just spiritually mature people. It is a step of maturity that few are willing to take, but it is so life-giving and so good, and that's the whole heart behind this book.
Well, I have to say, I really love the title Subversive Sabbath, because that is what I kept thinking when I was reading the book, is this, and it goes back to kind of the entire Christian witness to society, where the world says this is how, or society says this is how the world works. I think the call of the Christian is to say, no, actually it doesn't. It works this way, and to subvert the way the world says it works and be in touch with the most real reality that we could ever know. And part of that is knowing and realizing that God created us to take a break once a week and submit in Sabbath.
Yeah. Amen.
Well, AJ, man, I've had such a good time talking with you, and also just reading this book was such a joy, and it was life-giving to me. And so, Dan, thanks always. I always enjoy every interaction you and I have, and I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show.
Yeah, same to you. And Shane, thank you for your service to the church with this phenomenal podcast. It's a joy to serve you, and I look forward to our continued conversation and friendship.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. But